93.3 FM, community radio for University of Guelph. We'll be there.
Este verano, el Festival de Música Internacional Kultrum se llevará a cabo del 9 al 12 de julio en Kitchener. Conciertos y eventos gratis el fin de semana. El festival es el único de la región que celebra la diversidad. Este año se llevará en conjunto con los Juegos Panamericanos. Artistas invitados, Ana Tijoux, Chico Trujillo, Los Bam Bam, Lucho Quesana y muchos más. También habrá actividades interactivas para todas las edades, talleres, cuentacuentos, teatro, comida y artesanías. Venga, salude al equipo de CFRU que estará transmitiendo en vivo. Este año el festival estará ubicado en Campos Verdes del Parque Victoria. Este lugar es accesible. Para más información visite la página nerudaarts.ca. Reserve la fecha, julio, del 9 al 12 en Kitchener, Waterloo. Ahí nos vemos.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Weizmann's notion is not merely figurative, it is literal as well. For example, where the West Bank's unlit, broken, potholed, or altogether unpaved Palestinian roads cross the well-lit, well-paved, vigilantly patrolled Jewish bypass roads, they plunge beneath them into tunnels. Jews traverse the landscape above, Arabs below. Israeli apartheid, in other words, functions in the vertical plane as well as the horizontal. One effect of this is, whenever possible, to render Palestinians invisible to Jewish colonists and to Israelis driving within eyesight of the West Bank. And if not invisible, then at least part of the background over and against which the modern infrastructure is built. Thus, Jewish colonists traversing the West Bank or Israelis driving on the highway parallel to the West Bank very often do not see Palestinians. They are in tunnels below or on the other side of the 8-meter-high separation wall. Seen from the Palestinian side, the wall is, unmistakably, a wall. Its brutalist design communicates unequivocally to Palestinians what Israel thinks of them. Seen from the Israeli side, however, the wall is often not really a wall, and as you know, they often talk about it as a fence rather than a wall. In many sections, like this one, it is smoothed over into the landscape, and its scale is disguised by shrubs, trees, and landscaping that gradually rises and falls, offsetting the severity that is so brutally and expressively naked on the Palestinian side. These are the same section of wall. I took both these pictures, and they're just from opposite sides of the wall, one on the Israeli side, one on the Palestinian side, but it's the same 10 or 15 slabs of concrete. From the Israeli point of view, the effect is not only to render the Palestinians on the other side of the wall invisible, but, even if only momentarily, to render the process of rendering them invisible itself invisible. When possible, in other words, the wall as the signifier, the sign of erasure, is erased in turn, as though there was some magic trick that would erase the Palestinians from the landscape without the trace of that erasure being itself evident. In other places, the wall is written into the landscape from the Israeli side in the sense that it is painted over in such a way as to render it as pure background. In some cases, a pristine landscape is painted on the wall, replacing not only the actuality of the wall, but also the undesirable real landscape of living Palestinians. In other cases, the wall is painted over with decorative arches to disguise it as something other than what it actually is, even as something that connects, like a Roman aqueduct, rather than separates.
I mean, we've had 50 years of assault on Palestinian rights. I think they're the most terrorized, or at least with the Iraqi people, they're the most terrorized people on earth, and have been for so many years. Practically every Palestinian lives in constant harassment, threat of violence, humiliation, been that way for a long, long time.
مين الهابي انت الهابي مين الهابي انا الهابي كيف إرهابي وأنا عايش ببلادي مين إرهابي؟ أنت إرهابي ماكلني وأنا عايش ببلادي قتلني زي ما تلت إجدادي
أجل القانون
على الفاضي ما أنت يعد وبتلعب دور الشاهد المحامي والقاضي علي قاضي نهايتي بادي حلمك انقل فوق معنى آلية حلمك لآلية تصير بالمقابر أخطرية ديمقراطية
والله لكم ناسية
من كثر ما اغتصبتوا النفس العربية
هبلت ولدت
ولد اسمه عمليا انفجارية وهنا ديتنا إرهابية
يعني ضربني وبكيت سبقني واشتكيت لما ذكرتك انك بدين
نطيت وحكيت
ما انتو بتخلوا ولاد صغار يرمحجار ما لهمش أهل يدبوهم بالدار ايش كنو نسيت انو استحق ضب الأهل تحت الأشجار وعلى لما وجع الفار بتناديني إرهابي
مين إرهابي؟ أنا إرهابي كيف إرهابي وأنا عايش في بلادي؟ مين إرهابي؟ أنت إرهابي ماكلني وأنا عايش في بلادي
ليش إرهابي؟ عشان دمي مش هادي حامي عشان رافع راسي وأرض بلادي قتلوا حبايبي
أنا لحالي
أهلي تشردوا
راح أضلي أنادي
أنا مش ضد السلام السلام ضدي علي بده يقضي طراسي بده يمحي واللي بيحكي كلمة بشد ورا همة بيكون زلمة
تعملوا منه رمة
ومين أنتو؟ لسه أمتى خبرتوا؟ اتصلوا عدا شتلتوا عدا شتمتوا إمياتنا بيبكوا أبياتنا بيشكوا أراضينا بيخطفوا
أنا بقولكم مين أنتو؟
أنتو كبرتوا بدلا إحنا كبرنا فقر مين كبر في وسع ومين كبر في جحر صار في داعي عملتوا منه إجرامي وأنت يا إرهابي بتناديني إرهابي
مين إرهابي؟ أنا إرهابي كيف إرهابي وأنا عايش ببلادي؟ مين إرهابي؟ أنت إرهابي ماكلني وأنا عايش ببلادي أمتى ببطل إرهابي؟ لما تضربني كف واعطيك خد تاني كيف تتوقع مني اشكر الاذاني تعرف ايش انت قولي كيف دخياني راكع ركبي وايدي مربطات عيون بالارض وجثث مفتتات بيوت مهدوم عائلات مشردات اطفال يتيمه حريه بكلبشات انت عمر انت اردن احنا بنغبر ما علينا بنصبر وجعنا بنستر اهم شيء انك تحس بامان اتريح وسيب لنا الالام معه دمنا دم كلاب حتى لا لما الكلب يموت في الرفق بالحيوان يعني دمنا ارخص من دم الكلاب لا دمي غالي رح ادافع حالي لو تناديني إرهابي
مين إرهابي مين إرهابي مين إرهابي مين إرهابي مين إرهابي مين إرهابي مين إرهابي انت إرهابي
كلها هذه الارض كانت جتون كلها
شوف شوف الشجره شوف مش حرام هذا كسروه حرام هذا عمره 200 سنة الشجر هذا 200 سنة كانت العالم تعيش منه تاكل منه راح كسروه
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, I am Siegfried. And that was MDC with Who's the Terrorist Now, a Palestinian rap group. And what we had at the beginning right there, the... was Sri Makhdizi, you know, a Palestinian academic who was talking about how in Palestine, you know, explaining how the Jewish occupation tries to hide effectively the brutality it inflicts on the Palestinian population and how, you know, they will build bypass roads, Israeli settlers to serve Israeli settlers in the West Bank, how they will override, you know, go over top of Palestinian roads, and how the Israeli apartheid wall on the Israeli side is smoothed into the landscape and camouflaged so Israelis don't even see the wall, which is so nakedly visible and brutal on the Palestinian side. You know, it's basically the occupation is hidden. The brutal reality of the occupation of Palestinian land is hidden from the Israelis themselves. You know, and of course we talk, like, this is just going, building on what I was talking about, the Palestinian struggle for liberation last week, you know, and just, this is a dynamic of the occupation a lot of people don't realize, they don't think about, they don't understand, is that physical aspect and attempts to hide the oppressed people entirely, you almost erase them from view. So they're out of sight, out of mind. And that, in fact, was the title of Sri Makhdizi's talk there, which he actually gave in Australia. I think that was back in 2009 or 2010. It was a while ago. But, I mean, this is the situation now, just like it was then. You know, where you have this kind of attempt to conceal this, obviously, criminal policy of apartheid and what it does to human beings. So, and this is like something that actually has been part of oppressive societies, colonial societies, like for, you know, going back almost like just centuries. I mean, even you look at how in Tsarist Russia, in the 18th century, in the 19th century, how peasants were portrayed in art, you know, in the kind of paintings that people from upper class backgrounds in Russia produced, like the kind of artwork they produced, how they portrayed the peasants. You know, they portrayed them as healthy, as like living in this, you know, pristine rural environment, you know, as happy, well-fed, all these kind of things, all these things that they were not. You know, these are peasants living under serfdom. You know, they have basically no control of their own lives. They're exploited by the landowners. You know, they can't leave the land. You know, they can be sold away from their families. They suffer almost the very similar conditions that slaves faced in the American South. And of course, there were major efforts to downplay the inhumanity of slavery in the United States as well. You know, in virtually every society where you've had like the basis of society has been the exploitation of a particular people or a particular class, they found ways to try to downplay that, try to conceal that, that so very inhuman aspect of society, this foundation of society based on exploitation. You know, they've tried to conceal that. You know, whether it's a slave society or a feudal society or a capitalist society, any society based on exploitation will try to conceal that, well, try to hide that exploitation from view. And it's the same thing where you have a colonial situation, you know, where the Israelis are trying to hide the Palestinians from view. You know, that's the case. I mean, and Shir Hever, who, of course, is a very very astute commentator on these matters, in this next report that he did just this past week on the Real News Network, he goes into the manifestations of Israeli apartheid and just really what it looks like and like how apartheid manifests itself throughout Israeli society. So I'm going to play that for you right now. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
This is the Real News Network. I'm Sharmini Peres coming to you from Baltimore. Last week, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was forced to instruct his defense minister to shelve a project segregating the bus lines for Palestinians and Israeli settlers due to heavy condemnation from several Israeli politicians as well as human rights organizations. Nevertheless, racial profiling and discriminatory inspections at checkpoints, airports, and bus terminals remain normalized in Israeli society under the banner of security. Here to discuss this with us is Shir Hever. He recently returned from Israel, but today he is joining us from Göttingen, Germany. He, as you know, is an economic researcher in the Alternative Information Center, a Palestinian-Israeli organization active in Jerusalem and Beit Shor. Shir, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Sharmini.
Shir, you just recently returned to Israel after a few years. When you return in this way, certain things stand out upon your return. What did you observe?
I think when somebody enters Israel, it takes exactly 5 seconds to see the first manifestation of apartheid. As soon as you leave the airplane, you see there are security guards with shiny vests who pick from the people leaving the aircraft, people who seem like young foreigners, the highest risk group for political activists who might be coming to Israel-Palestine in order to protest. And they are immediately taken aside and interrogated by these security guards, while the rest of the passengers can just walk by. That's the first instance that you see only 5 seconds after disembarking from the plane, how apartheid is being implemented in Israel. But that is actually not very new. This policy has been in place for about 10 years now. What is interesting is how many of the segregation policies that were implemented on the street level, on day-to-day lives of Israelis, have been rolled back a bit in a way that it doesn't affect the entire population, but it focuses specifically on people that look like they might be Arabs, people with dark skin. And that's something that you see very clearly in the central bus terminal of Jerusalem, Israel's biggest city. The central bus terminal is one of the most fortified locations in Israel. It has airport-level security where people just wanting to take the bus have to have their luggage scanned by machines, and they have to be inspected individually by the security guards. But now, all the security guards stand on the side and just look at the people coming into the building. And if these people look like they have dark skin, like they might be Palestinians, they're taken aside and they have to go through all the scans and show their documents. But people who don't look like that are just waved through. Now, this is something that has been called in apartheid South Africa, small apartheid. There's been a very interesting article just the other day by an Israeli jurist that mentioned this distinction between small apartheid and big apartheid in South Africa, where the small apartheid is what you see, like segregated benches, separate water fountains, that sort of thing, while the big apartheid is the segregation in human rights and in the freedom of movement. That's actually much more significant. What we saw with the Minister of Defense decision to have segregated bus lines so that Palestinians would not be allowed to get on the same bus as Israelis. When I say Israelis, I should be a bit more clear. We're talking about colonists in the illegal colonies in the West Bank. This regulation seems to make this small apartheid, where you have segregation on the daily life, too much to bear. And you said before this policy was canceled because of pressure by human rights organizations and by Israeli politicians. But in fact, it's not that there is a big outrage in the Israeli public against such a blatant racism. The worry of these people who spoke up against this policy is how it would look to the rest of the world. How will the world react when this apartheid would become so visible? Well, it's a bit absurd, because the apartheid is already completely visible. Anyone who visits Israel-Palestine will see it. You see it in Jerusalem, you see it in Tel Aviv, you see it on the street, you see it wherever you go. There is simply segregation between the different populations. Palestinians are not allowed to travel freely inside Israel, while Israelis have a lot of freedom of movement, and they can enter even into the West Bank and walk almost wherever.
Shir, one of the things that the New York Times reported is that that Prime Minister Netanyahu seemed to be surprised by the introduction of this pilot project, as they put it. And I was wondering whether this was in fact true, and also whether this is a result of having had to appoint the kind of people he's had to in his cabinet as he took office.
Well, in the previous government, the same Minister of Defense has implemented the same policy. To say that Netanyahu was surprised is very unlikely, because he knew that his defense minister, Moshe Yaalon, has already tried to implement this policy once. And it failed precisely because of the same reason, because it was immediately covered by a lot of international newspapers and international news agencies, where they said, well, this is obviously apartheid. Segregation based on race and ethnicity is something that maybe should not exist anymore in modern society. And they had to scuttle the project. The pressure to come forward with this kind of project comes from the right-wing organizations representing the colonists in the West Bank. They are claiming that the mere presence of Palestinians on the bus is a threat to their security, is making their bus ride uncomfortable or unpleasant, and they want the Palestinians out of their sight. And Moshe Yaalon, the Minister of Defense, was simply acquiescing to their pressure, and this is the second time he's doing that. And I think he believed that after the recent elections, the Israeli government is now more right-wing. The Israeli public has given a vote of confidence to the extreme right in Israel. So that the public will be willing to accept this policy, which almost passed already in the previous government. But I think Moshe Yaalon himself is a bit of an odd character here, because he himself is not part of those colonist organizations. The colonist organizations want to have segregation in the buses, but they want to have it everywhere. They want to say that all of what they call Israel, which includes all the occupied territory, which includes all of Palestine, they want to say all of this belongs to Jews, and only to Jews, and Palestinians should be only tolerated under extreme security conditions. And yet Moshe Yaalon, however, made a statement defending his policy, in which he said, why is it so strange that Israel wants to have security checks for people entering its borders, like any other country would want to check people entering its borders? His statement, which he gave to the Jerusalem Post, was very surprising, because he tacitly admitted that the Palestinian territory in the West Bank is not part of Israel. And that's something that the colonists who pushed for this policy certainly didn't want to happen. And I think Netanyahu didn't want this kind of statement either.
Now, finally, does this have anything to do with the European Minister for Foreign Affairs arriving in Israel? By this, I mean the way in which Netanyahu has dealt with this in asking for it to be retracted.
Well, Netanyahu is certainly very good at political timing. He understands that in the political, in the European Union, there's been discussions brewing over implementing sanctions against Israel, trying to force Israel to recognize its obligations under international law and to make Israel accountable for the violations. But the European foreign ministers have said we have to wait until the elections. We can't be seen as if we are interfering in the political process in another country. So we will wait with all of these discussions and all of these possible sanctions. Now the elections are over. There's a new government. It has just been approved. And there's nothing to keep the European Union from pushing forward with its policy. Netanyahu doesn't want this particular moment to be marred with a very obvious and shocking violations of human rights.
Shir Hever, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Sharmini, for having me.
And thank you for joining us on the Real News Network.
Yeah, yeah. Low key and the main man, Mr. Adoni, tell him how you feel.
Yo, low key, you know we take life for granted too much. Them crumbs that are left from our food and we throw away. People in Iraq or Palestine could live with it. Then 1p, 2p, 5p, throw it on the floor. Because we can't buy a matter with it, don't mean we can't save it and give it to charity.
Too many suffering, too many tears. To see how you die, I'm knowing for years. When we look around, nobody cares. And the people, they are living in fear. The system needs to change right now. Too much youth are good, don't mean that grave right now. Resource, now I want it back. Till I sever every single chain, I will not relax. Just constant attack, till my world looks like Montserrat. Contact my comrades for combat, what's conscious rap? When you say the truth, they attack like a saber tooth. Thinking clear, they make you disappear. Like you hate the fruit, don't need more Bowens. We don't need more Rebors, Weed or Lee or Cohens. They tell us about terrorism and tell us about terrorists. Look up the definition and tell us what terror is. Only know the definition if the television sell us it. Public enemy number one, they
treat me like Professor Griff. This album has been in the making a quarter century. Born to bless the beat and rap over recorded melody. I knew the truth since I was a small little boy. I am a product of the system I was born to destroy.
I can't believe I saw them cheat people. And they have to protect and them I beat people. I'm innocent of system in the street people. Can't believe them and delete people. The system is the change right now. Too much youth are good on me not grave right now. Innocent is bigger inside here right now. After I get the people I'm not slave right now. Oh boy, the system is the change right now. Too much youth are good on me not grave right now. Innocent is bigger inside here right now. After I get the people I'm not slave right now. Yeah, yeah.
On the news, they glorify their own henchmen. Support the troops, but won't mention Joe Clinton. It's funny cause the rappers are posing as the gangsters while the government take your money as bonuses for bankers. In life you learn to close your eyes and hold your tongue, but together we will overcome. There's never been a chosen one. Still trying to understand the land I stand on. I'll probably die from cancer, a sanger like Franz Fanon. Never give up, I will never just quit. I will never give in, I will never submit. The reason that I came is bleeding from the veins of the people. Cause we're equal, only freedom is the aim. This album has been in the making a quarter century. Born to bless the beat and rap over recorded melody. I knew the truth since I was a small little boy. I am a product of the system I was born to destroy.
I can't believe I saw them cheat people. And they have to protect and them I beat people. I'm innocent of system in the street people. Can't believe them and delete people. The system is the change right now. Too much youth are good on me not grave right now. Innocent is bigger inside the years right now. After get some people I'm a slave right now.
To corporate guys supplying your orders. You're fighting fire with fire. I'm fighting fire with water. When they kill me, I know I'll die with a focused mind. Plus there'll be millions of me ready to multiply. Don't just mention, acknowledge me. Remember to honor me. My pen and its honesty. Defended equality. Declared a republic and ended your monarchy. Your corporate dictatorship pretends it's democracy. I hold your bloodline accountable for every crime. Adam Smith to Rothschild, it's all been a clever lie. Two choices now, revolution or genocide. But thanks to Rupert Murdoch, neither one will be televised. This album has been in the making a quarter century. Born to bless the beat and rap over recorded melody. I knew the truth since I was a small little boy. I am a product of the system I was born to destroy.
I can't believe I saw them cheat people. And they have to protect and them I beat people. I'm innocent of systems in the street people. Can't believe them and delete people. The system is the change right now. Too much youth are good on me not grave right now. Innocent is bigger inside the years right now. After get up people I'm a slave right now. Oh boy, system is the change right now. Too much youth are good on me not grave right now. Innocent is bigger inside the years right now. After get up people I'm a slave right now. Yeah, yeah.
Iraq.
Libya,
Yemen,
Syria,
Bahrain,
Algeria,
Somalia,
Tunisia,
Palestine,
Nigeria,
all the way to Bolivia, all of humanity, we all are familiar. We have more that makes us similar with each other. Big up them countries that are named
Venezuela to Mesopotamia.
We love you. Big up Akhoya Loki.
Big up Akhoya Adnan.
Khalas.
Khalas.
Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
Hi, I'm James Gordon, and you are fortunate enough to be listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
Attention comrades of Canadian DIY communities and underground art scenes.
This is our house, Weird Distro, the first and only not-for-profit online store for Canadian-made cassettes, LPs, CDs, and objets d'art.
One stop, one package, one massive country.
Run by Weird Canada volunteers.
For music to hold in your hands and your hearts, check out Weird Distro at distro.weirdcanada.com.
This summer, North by Northeast is back to take over Toronto. North by Northeast is Toronto's festival destination for emerging musicians and major label headliners. Where else can you see and discover over hundreds of bands? This year's NXNE features the likes of the New Pornographers, Best Coast, and many more. June 17th through the 21st, one of the most anticipated events of the summer takes over Toronto. The festival takes place in various locations across Toronto and therefore has varied accessibility. For more information about tickets, schedule, accessibility, and everything else, check out nxne.com. This is one festival you won't want to miss out on. North by Northeast, from June 17th to the 21st in Toronto.
Imagine something different.
The politics of austerity are driving environmental destruction and deepening inequality on a planetary scale, and mass movements have formed all over the globe to resist it. From Quebec to Greece to Chile to South Africa, millions are rising up against austerity. Let's join them.
On Saturday, June 13th, activists, organizers, and community members from throughout southwestern Ontario will meet for the regional summit to unite against austerity at 95 Crimea Street in Guelph, just across from the food bank. The event runs from 3 to 9 p.m. and will feature workshops, educationals, trainings, and a panel discussion.
Attendance is free, food and childcare will be provided, and the event is wheelchair accessible. For more information on the summit and the effects of austerity generally, go to uniteagainstausterity.ca or contact ontarioagainstausterity@gmail.com.
This indigenous isle, from pillaging fat cats, sitting on money piles, doing dirty deeds of the first
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. So just before the break, of course, we had Shir Hever talking about manifestations of apartheid Israel on the Real News Network. And we had Lowkey with his song Soundtrack to the Struggle, which I think kind of encapsulates really the importance of struggling against systems of oppression around the world, however they manifest. And of course, apartheid Israel is only one of the better known examples with regard to that. So, I mean, once again, I mentioned last week how, you know, the crimes that Saudi Arabia is committing right now in Yemen and in Bahrain are almost like, you know, you never even hear them on the news. You never hear it mentioned, you know, even though thousands of people are dying and have been dying pretty much since March. You know, this is what's been going on. And so we have to understand, like, what the nature of imperialism is if we want to fight back against it, you know, and that's a very important thing. And, you know, not only are we talking about imperialism overseas? We're talking about, like, imperialism as it manifests in our own backyard, whether we're talking about indigenous, the struggle of indigenous peoples for self-determination in this country, in Canada, or around the world in general. And, like, you also see how African-Americans, this is something, of course, I've talked about a lot on the show, given the kind of struggles that have been going on over the past few years, African-American people struggling against the racist system that kind of keeps them in a subordinate position, a position of exploitation, open to police brutality in very shocking ways. And probably one of the most shocking manifestations of police brutality, certainly in the city of Baltimore, which happened about 30 years ago, just this past week, was the bombing of the headquarters of the MOVE movement. Literally, what happened is a police helicopter dropped a bomb on the headquarters of a African-American organization in Baltimore 30 years ago, just this past week. And that ended up burning down an entire city block and killing about a dozen people. You know, that's how far police brutality went in that instance. Like, they were willing to actually drop a bomb on a residential neighborhood. You know, I don't think it, I need to explain the kind of parallels between that and, say, what goes on in a place like Gaza. You know, but that's literally how far that went. And of course, what this this next clip, which you know, Jared Ball, activist and academic in Baltimore, did a really good job covering the demonstrations, which marked the 30th anniversary of this atrocity. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. You know, he did a really good job of covering that. And, like, there were actually really substantial demonstrations in Baltimore surrounding this anniversary. Saying, like, they have historical memory, they understand what happened back then, like, you know, the tie-ins between past struggles and the struggle that they're going through now to secure justice for Freddie Gray, you know, and the kind of and the people who have been murdered by the police in recent years. They understand the connection there. They're not blind to that, and that in many cases is almost a source of strength for these movements that are going on right now. So I'm gonna tell you right now, there definitely is some definitely profanity in this broadcast. I mean, there's a lot of angry people in these demonstrations, and you know that anger totally is justified. So I decided not to cut that out or anything. So I'm just gonna play that for you right now. This is Jared Ball's report on the 30th anniversary of the MOVE bombing in Baltimore. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
What's up, world, and welcome to this special edition of I Mix What I Like for the Real News Network. I'm Jared Ball. We're here in Philadelphia at the rally, march, and later the panel commemorating 30 years since the May 1985 bombing of the MOVE organization, again here in Philly up the road at Osage Avenue. This is also a rally in commemoration for all political prisoners, and specifically Mumia Abu-Jamal. So stay with us and check it out. This is what it looked and sounded like.
We're here in front of the 18th Police District in here in Philadelphia, here for the 30th year anniversary of the bombing of my family, the MOVE organization. And I want to say one thing. The City of Philadelphia Police Department been pulling black people by the scruff of their necks, beating, kicking, maiming, killing, beating our family, our women into miscarriage, locking our men up. And it ain't just the MOVE organization. It's poor black people, poor white people, yes. Poor Latino people, yes. People that can't afford these motherfucking ass Mercedes Benzes and all that shit that they think they can stomp upon. Yes. And I just want to let this motherfucking police department know, no fucking more. The internet is here and people is blasting your asses, right, in front of the whole goddamn world. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Jared Ball, Bashi Rose, back again for I Mix What I Like in the Real News Network. Again, from live from Philadelphia, covering the commemoration of the 30th anniversary of the bombing of the MOVE House. And we're here with Rain Africa. Just if you would, tell us what you think about what we're doing here. What is going on with MOVE today? What would you like people to know about the MOVE organization, the MOVE movement, and the 30th anniversary we're here commemorating?
Well, the MOVE organization was founded by John Africa. He's the coordinator and founder of the MOVE organization. He was one of the 11 who was murdered May 13th, 1985. He has the teachings and the quotes that we live by, even to this day, and it's still such a powerful thing where you can't kill the messenger. Well, you can kill the messenger, but you can't kill the message. Because obviously, I was born 15 years after May 13th. I never met anyone in that house. My father was 5 years old at that time. But the message still lives on. It still goes on, and 30 years later, we're stronger than we ever were. Way stronger. It's way more of us. It's just amazing. And the fact that MOVE cannot be broken. We can't be broken. They have killed us. Mommy, I'm on... Sorry. But they have killed us. They've hurt our babies. They have kicked us into miscarriage. They've beat us, our men, bloody, near death. But you can't break us. We're still here. We're still fighting. The MOVE organization, we fight for all life forms. We don't just fight for human rights or environmental rights. We don't separate it. We fight for all. And that's what brought us to the clash is with the Philadelphia police and the government was that we spoke out and we were peaceful with it, though. We spoke at the zoo and we did elderly homes where they were neglecting the elderly in the early 70s. So they would come out and they would make us move. Oh, you can't do that. You can't speak out because those are untouched subjects that they don't want to speak out about. And it eventually led up to May 13th, 1985, where they took a C4 bomb. And Lynn Abraham, a mayoral candidate, a bitch at that, is running for mayor now. She signed illegal warrants to come out that day. Warrants that had nothing, that were false, that had no basis to them. And then eventually, after the killing of 11 people, also helped put Ramona Africa in prison for 7 years. And she was a political prisoner at that time. So we're just, right now, our goal is not to, for people not to forget May 13th, but also to free our Move 9. And this year we had the passing of Phil Africa. They murdered him in prison. One day he was absolutely fine, and then the next 6 days later he was dead. Merle Africa, they killed
him. Right, I was going to ask you, who do you have pictured here on these posters?
So on this one, I have Merle Africa. I think it's a very prominent example of what's going to happen to Phil, also happened to her 2 years before I was born in 1998. She was also killed in the prison. And John Africa, I have to wrap up though, but John Africa said...
We understand, we're keeping it moving, movers marching, on a move, and all of that good stuff.
All I want to say with ending it is long live John Africa, long live revolution, and long live the people who keep the revolution going.
Thank you very much. On a move.
Black lives matter! Blue lives matter! Black lives matter! Blue lives matter! Black lives matter! Blue lives matter!
Revolution!
We're free to win. I'll lose tomorrow.
All right, everybody, this is Jared Ball, Bashi Rose, Real News Network, imixwhatilike.org, here with the chairman, Fred Hampton Jr., here in Philadelphia, obviously trying to show support to a lot of different things, MOVE, MUMIA, political prisoners. Tell everybody why you're here in particular.
Well, first of all, I'm honored and humbled to be here. I'm still, as what Chairman Fred Hampton Sr. would say, hi to people. I'm just literally coming back from the West Coast. We're Oakland, Sacramento, and a couple more places. Then we hit Baltimore, and now here in Philadelphia. A major campaign. Yo, Brother Marsh, Eddie Conway, right on. I see you, my brother. Come on in the room, man. Real talk. It's good to see you. It's good to see you out here.
This is perfect.
Real talk, man. I know I did. I had to make up for some hunger strikes I was on like that.
So this is perfect because we're recording our interview. So this is perfect. Eddie Conway works with us at the Real News as well. And this is a legendary meeting. We're happy to be getting this on tape.
That's right. You know what I'm saying? Glad to be here with you.
Last time I seen him was on a prison visit. Last time I seen him was on a prison visit.
10 years.
Oh, so man. A little chubby and relatively free and skinny and on a block, right? So we are.
That's right. Keep
still in fighting shape, though.
So to the young people in particular who we know we want us to see this, what would the both of you have to say about why you're here and why it's important that they remember this struggle and continue this kind of struggle? I'll start with you, Chairman Fred, and then we'll come to Brother Eddie Conway here in a second.
Oh, well, as I just said, I'm half the people right now. It's important that, you know what I'm saying, when we talk about such terms as terrorism, that people, you know what I'm saying, put in the correct context. You know what I'm saying? The deal is, a lot of times when we say terms like terrorism, people automatically identify with situations like New York, you know, September 11th. We have a position that we say, you know, our African people in particular, who are the OVs, the original victims of terrorism, who have been terrorized under such euphemisms as gentrification, which really is nothing but land grab, the growing prison industrial complex, which really is the mass kidnapping of African and other colonized people and placing inside those, you know, them concentration camps. Even the term police brutality is a euphemism. We say it's police terrorism. In fact, every day in one way or another, it's September 11th for us. And we say, kind of like the Alcoholics Anonymous says, the first step in addressing the problem is recognizing that we have a problem. Being oppressed is embarrassing. We do acknowledge that. However, we must heighten the level of consciousness. We understand that we not only can be victims, we recognize we as victims, but that are fighting back victims. So that's one thing to the youth and to our community in general. We have to acknowledge these contradictions and deal with them.
And where do people go to find your work and continue to follow and join and support and all of that good stuff?
Well, they call me the band man now. And they shut me down off all the major media in Chicago. They just hit me on Facebook again. So hit me on my blog spot, www.chairmanfredjr.blog.
blogspot.com.
All right, that's what's up.
Right on.
Can I get one for my girls?
Hey, keep your heads up, eyes open, the fist clenched. Y'all know how we do this here. And we say, what's the call? Free them all.
That's right. Right on. That's what's up. Eddie Conway, I know you're here for the real news. We're doing some of the same work, but you are also someone who is celebrated in these spaces as again, original victim, as Fred Jr. just said, recently relatively freed from the Holocaust and the concentration camps and the prisons.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit why it's important for you to be here, both as a journalist and a participant.
Well, it's important, I think, one, to cover this, to have this story out, because like the major medias don't report this kind of stuff. They don't tell us that this stuff is going on all over the whole country. You know, so we need to have a voice of our own. That's one of the reasons we're here. But the other reason is it's symbolic. Like I just did 44 years in the Maryland prison system as a political prisoner. Other political prisoners need to see this and understand that this is a victory of the people and that I'm here, they can be here, and eventually we will get them all here. But we also need to bring forth our history and let people know what happened to us in the history and how we were struggling, but also why they need to take up the banner and they need to build and organize and move forward into the future, because it's not over.
That's what's up. Marshal Eddie Conway, Chairman Fred Hampton Jr. I'm Jared Ball for the Real News Network. I mix what I like. Bashi Rose, peace if you're willing to fight for it, as his father used to say. We'll catch you in the whirlwind. Peace, everybody.
I mix what I like.
Could say real rock from the rock, an unusual musical happening in a most unusual place. The state prison
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and said they were suckers. They wanted me for their army or whatever. Picture me giving a damn, I said never. Here's a land that never gave a damn about a brother like me and myself, because they never did. I wasn't with it, but just that very minute it occurred to me the suckers had authority. Cold sweating as I dwell in my cell. How long has it been they got me sitting in a state pen? I gotta get out, but that thought was thought before. I contemplated a plan on the cell floor. I'm not a fugitive on the run, but a brother like me begun to be another one. Public enemy serving time, they drew the line, y'all. They criticized me for some crime. Nevertheless, they could not understand that I'm a black man and I can never be a veteran. On the strength of situations unreal, I got a raw deal, so I'm looking for the steel.
Yo, Chuck, we're gonna break you out of here, man. Where's the strength, G?
I'm going for that. I grabbed his gun and he did what I said so. And every man's a man got served, along with the time they served. Decency was deserved. To understand my demands, I gave a warning. I wanted the governor, y'all, and plus the warden to know that I was innocent. Because I'm militant, posing a threat, you better government. My plan said I had to get out and break north. Just like Oliver's neck, I had to get off. My boys had the feds in check. They couldn't try nothing. We had a force to instigate a prison riot. This is what it takes for peace, so I just took the peace. Black for black, it's high time to cut the leash. Freedom to get out to the ghetto. No sellout. Six COs we got, we ought to put their head out. But I'll give them a chance, cause I'm civilized. As for rest of the world, they can't realize a cell is hell. I'm a rebel, so I rebel. Between bars got me thinking like an animal. Got a woman CO to call me a copter. She tried to get away and I popped her twice. Right now I wanna get nice. I had six COs and now it's five to go. And I'm serious, call me delirious, but I'm still a captive. I gotta rap, it's time to break. As time grows a tent, I got my steel in my right hand. Now I'm looking for the fence.
Hey yo, Chuck, we got the dope plan in effect. G, word to the strap, man.
I'm looking for that. As I ventured into the courtyard, followed by 52 brothers, bruised, battered, and scarred but hard. Going out with a bang, ready
to the bang out. The power from the sky and from the tower, shots rang out. A high number of dose, yes, and something close. I figure I trigger my steel stand and hold my post. This is what I mean, an anti-nigga machine. If I come out alive, then they won't come clean. Then I threw up, my steel bullets flew up. And to my surprise, the wall and tower blew up. Who shot what, who, what, the bazooka was who? And to my rescue, it was the S1W. Secure my getaway, so I just got away. The joint broke from the black smoke. Then they saw it was rougher than the average bluffer, cause the steel was black, the attitude exact. Now the chase is on, telling you to come on. 53 brothers on the run, and we are gone.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Public Enemy with Black Steel in the Hour of Chaos. And before that, we had, of course, the Jared Ball's coverage. It was actually in Philadelphia, not in not in Baltimore. I misspoke before I played that clip. In Philadelphia, where the 30th anniversary, on the 13th of May, the bombing of the headquarters of the MOVE organization, African American Liberation Organization, it was bombed 30 years ago. By the police, and an entire city block was burned down in Philadelphia, and about a dozen people died. This is still remembered there. And of course, you know, you heard that kind of strong language that they had, you know, the anger that is still felt and the defiance that is still felt about that event. And like, of course, how that ties in with the, you know, more recent police killings and the kind of environment of racism that African Americans have had to face in Philadelphia and in the United States as a whole. You know, this is the language that often does not get heard. You know, people don't understand, like, just how intense this is. And, you know, that's why I wanted to play that. You know, I gave some ample warning there, you know, of what was going to be said. But, you know, at the same time, I think that needs to be heard by people to understand, like, what the, you know, that this is real. That oppression is definitely real. And the resistance against that oppression is also real. You know, people have to understand this. Now, a lot of things, you know, one of the things that, you know, of course, we've been kind of seeing, like, over the last while, I mean, a lot of people, like, felt that after Barack Obama was elected president in 2008, that effectively there was kind of, like, this false narrative that was propagated, basically saying, like, you know, systemic racism is basically over in the United States because we have a black person in the White House. You know, that was, like, a myth at the time that that was kind of going on. Obviously, people do not believe that myth anymore. Certainly, the vast majority of people who did believe it at the time certainly have backed away from that more recently, you know, and certainly there's been a lot of resistance from the black community against some of the policies that Obama has put in place that certainly have not served the interests of the black community, that have not had a liberatory effect on African Americans. In fact, quite the opposite. And, you know, certainly there has been a increasing realization among African Americans, they cannot rely on the system to liberate them. They have to rely on themselves. They can only rely on themselves and their own organizations, their mobilization, their ability to build alliances with other oppressed peoples, you know, and build solidarity, internationalism, this kind of thing. This is really what's going to get results for them. And it's not going to be, you know, getting an African American appointed to, like, Attorney General or like or the Justice Ministry or any of these kind of, like, you know, top posts in the American government. That's not what's going to do it, you know, because we've seen that. You know, we've seen, like, African Americans get appointed to top positions in recent years. I mean, not just in the Obama administration, but before then we had, like, Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice and all these people. That didn't mean liberation for African Americans in general. You know, that meant nothing of the kind. That just meant, like, a few people were going to be let into the system and allowed to get to these top jobs because they played the game. They knew how to play the game. You know, which is very, very different from the actual emancipation of people, of ordinary people, you know, from a system that oppresses them. You know, instead you have a select group of people joining into that system and becoming part of it. And that is not, obviously not what's going to solve the problem of racism in America. So, increasingly that's been recognized. Like, the next clip I'm going to play is from two African-American intellectuals of considerable standing, and that's Cornel West and Tavis Smiley. And this is the what they were talking about on Democracy Now! Just earlier this year. and just basically talking about why calling Obama a progressive ignores his record. I think that pretty much says it all. So I'm going to play that right now. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
DemocracyNow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, and we are on the road in Chicago. I'll be at noon in San Francisco on Saturday, speaking at Greenfest, and Sunday, 1:30, with Noam Chomsky and University of Michigan Professor Juan Cole in Princeton at the Nassau Presbyterian Church. But right now, we're in Chicago, and as the most expensive presidential election in U.S. history has come to an end, we turn to an issue that impacts more and more people in this country, but was rarely mentioned during the campaign. Poverty. The price tag for combined spending by federal candidates, along with their parties and outside groups like super PACs, totaled more than $6 billion. This is especially striking at a time when one in six Americans is poor, with over 16 million children living in poverty. Poverty rates for blacks and Latinos are twice as high as the rates for whites. There is greater poverty among women than men, and the rate of women living in extreme poverty has reached record highs. But a study released by the media watchdog group FAIR, that's Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, they reveal that poverty as an issue has been nearly invisible in U.S. media coverage of the 2012 presidential race. It found just 17 of the 10,489 campaign stories studied, that's 0.2%, address poverty in any substantive way. Critics have pointed out that President Obama was viewed as the anti-poverty candidate in 2008, but his reelection bid 4 years later has barely mentioned the poor, even though their numbers have gone up. Well, for more, we're joined by two guests who've worked diligently to get poverty back on the national agenda. Dr. Cornel West is with us, professor of philosophy and Christian practice at Union Theological Seminary in New York and professor emeritus at Princeton University. He's a New York Times bestselling author of numerous books and co-host of the radio show Smiley and Tavis, Smiley and West with Tavis Smiley. Together, they've written the new book, The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto. Tavis Smiley is a TV, radio, broadcaster, philanthropist, New York Times bestselling author. He hosts the PBS show Tavis Smiley and two radio shows, The Tavis Smiley Show on NPR and Smiley and West with Cornel West. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now!
Good to see you, Amy.
Blessing
you. It's good to be with you. So we're right here in the president's city. In fact, he just flew out on Wednesday after his reelection. Cornel West, the figures, who is ahead, who isn't, as your book and is titled The Rich and the Rest of Us?
Well, one, I think that it's morally obscene and spiritually profane to spend $6 billion on elections. $2 billion on a presidential election and not have any serious discussion. Poverty, trade unions being pushed against the wall, dealing with stagnating and declining wages when profits are still up and the 1% are doing very well. No talk about drones dropping bombs on innocent people. So we end up with such a narrow, truncated political discourse as the major problems, ecological catastrophe, climate change, global warming. So it's very sad. I mean, I'm glad there was not a right-wing takeover. But we end up with a Republican, a Rockefeller Republican in blackface with Barack Obama. So that our struggle in regard to poverty intensifies.
That's a pretty rough assessment of President Obama.
Oh, that's what we have. That's what we have. Richard Nixon is to the left of him on health care. Richard Nixon is to the left of him on guaranteed income. And the same policies in terms of imperial foreign policy is at work. And so I was glad to see that Romney didn't win. We pushed back a right-wing takeover. We've got a right-wing mentality. Cut, cut, cut. Austerity, austerity, austerity. Where is the serious talk about investment and jobs? Fighting the privatizing of education and the empowerment of trade unions. And so our battle is just beginning. We have yet to take off the gloves. Yeah, we've been fighting intensely.
President Obama said to Harry Belafonte, according to Harry, "Why don't you and Cornel West cut me some slack?" And Cornel and Harry Belafonte responded, "What makes you think we're not?"
That's exactly right.
I want to ask you about Bill O'Reilly, Tavis Smiley. I don't know if you were watching Fox on election night, but this is what Bill O'Reilly had to say about the outcome of the election.
So what's your sense of the evening? I mean, you look at these exit polls, you look at the, you know,
where... My sense of the evening is if Mitt Romney loses in Ohio, the president is reelected.
How do you think we got to that point? I mean, President Obama's approval rating was so low, and obviously this is hypothetical. We don't know who's even winning right now, never mind who won. But how do you think it got this tight?
Because it's a changing country. The demographics are changing. It's not a traditional America anymore. And there are 50% of the voting public who want stuff. They want things. And who is going to give them things? President Obama. He knows it, and he ran on it. And whereby 20 years ago, President Obama would have been roundly defeated by an establishment candidate like Mitt Romney. The white establishment is now the minority. And the voters, many of them, feel that this economic system is stacked against them, and they want stuff. You're going to see a tremendous Hispanic vote for President Obama. Overwhelming black vote for President Obama, and women will probably break President Obama's way. People feel that they are entitled